Welcome to another episode of Invigorate Your Business with George Strombolis. Today, I sit down with Effie Panagopoulos. She is the first Greek woman to have ever started an alcohol beverage brand in the world. Pretty spectacular. Her brand is called Kleos, and she is doing incredible things. She's an industry veteran in this space, and we're gonna sit down and talk about her entire business, what it's like from starting the company, running it, raising capital, being a female entrepreneur in this arena, and we're gonna cover everything. So enjoy this episode starting now. My name is George Strombolis, and I'm extremely passionate about traveling the world, meeting new people, and learning about new businesses. Join me as I sit down with other entrepreneurs to learn about their journeys. This episode of Invigorate Your Business starts now. So we'll get started right now. I'm excited to have Effie Panagopoulos.
Yes.
Panagopoulos here.
Panagopoulos.
She's a killer from the East Coast, right? From Boston, born and raised. The first, this is kind of a cool title, the first Greek woman in history to start an alcohol brand, a spirit brand.
So I wanna preface this just so we don't have any Greeks that are gonna be like, no. So in terms of the research, there may have been some woman in a chorio making tsipouro or tsipoudia or something in the past. But in terms of a brand that is exported outside of Greece and not part of a family, meaning I'm the first independent female, meaning this isn't my family's company. I've done this all on my own. So the first self-started Greek woman-owned spirit brand.
Let's go. Yeah. Come on. Let's go. That's huge. We're going to get into this. And the grandmothers in the village that were making alcohol, they were shitty marketers. So that's on them, right? They couldn't get it out. So we're going to get into this. You have tremendous history in the spirit space, the alcohol space, big brands, Bacardi and so on. So you're corporate. You decided at some point, you know what? I can bring something extraordinarily tasty and great to the market and start your own brand. We're going to get into that. Kleos, also pronounced Kleos.
Yes.
Right? You started that. It's based with Mastika. We're going to talk about that. But I would love for you to just kind of introduce yourself. Where are you from? What's your background?
So Effie Panagopoulos, Boston born and raised. My parents were from Tripoli and Megalopoli. Dad has passed. Grandparents, Kalamata and Sparti. So all Peloponnese. A lot of Chiotas, you know, ask me if I'm from Chios. And I always say, I think my soul lived there in a past life because I'm so obsessed with Mastika, but I'm not from Chios. And I've actually lived all over in the U.S. So I traveled a lot with work, kind of chasing the career. I did Vegas, San Diego, San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Miami, back to Boston, back to New York, back to Miami, and now California, new California resident. So,
well, welcome. We'll get into how you like it here and everything. How did you go from working for a global brand like Bacardi and then having the idea, like, was there an overlap there while you were at Bacardi to have this idea?
So no, I was at Bacardi back in 04 to 06. It was actually my first market manager role and I was actually living in San Francisco at the time. So,
okay.
Yeah, I got recruited by Remy Cointreau, which is the French company that owns Methaxa. So I was the first and only ever national brand ambassador for Methaxa to the United States.
To this day, no.
Yep. That job brought me back to Greece and I was there for a global brand conference and I stayed for vacation after the conference and I was in Mykonos. It was summer of 2008 at the beach bar Namos, which everyone knows. At the time, it was way cooler and a little more underground. And there was still Greeks there, but everyone around me was doing shots of Mastika. And I was with a music producer friend of mine and he literally was like, you need to try this. And so I tasted it and that was kind of my eureka moment. I had a number of thoughts in my head all at the same time, which A was, I know this flavor profile because, you know, we grow up having Mastika as that hipovrigio, that spoon dessert. And so I knew the flavor profile.
Yes.
And, you know, smell and taste are very evocative when it comes to waking up memories, right?
Absolutely.
So it really like brought me back to being in the Joryo with my yaya in the summertime, having that spoon dessert. And I'm like, fuck, they make alcohol from this, you know? And frankly, at the time, I didn't even really know what mastija was.
Right.
That it was a tree sap. I just thought it was like a Greek sweet, right? And so 2007, Saint Germain had launched, which was a brand that a friend of mine, rest in peace, Rob Cooper, started. And it was a French elderflower liqueur. And it lit up like wildfire in New York because it was a totally unique flavor profile that opened up a whole new world of cocktail opportunities. So I had, like I said, these thoughts at the same time of like, I know this flavor. They make alcohol from this. Ooh, this could be the next Saint Germain, right? Because in tasting it, I'm like, this is a flavor that would definitely lend itself to cocktail applications and a lot of versatility, right? And mixability. And so, yeah. And I mean, again, at the environment that I was in, which was Namos, which is like, you know, bottles and party and the whole thing.
And it's
all Americans, I'm telling you, that were doing the shots. It wasn't Greeks.
Okay.
And so that was really where I was like, okay. Because here I was working on Metaxa and Ouzo by Metaxa, which are two very challenging flavor profiles for a global consumer.
Right.
And I taste this thing that was like so approachable and really delicious. Again, for that, let's call it American consumer. Because let's face it, when it comes to many products across consumer packaged goods, if you can crack the American market, you can become a global brand, right?
Yep.
So that was really like that crucial moment. And my friend, who was the music producer, was friends with the owner of Skinos and was like, let me introduce you to this guy that has this brand. And so that was kind of the beginning of that whole journey. So I helped Skinos kind of enter the US market. I helped him find a distributor and an importer. Didn't work out financially for us to work together. And also during the 8-month period that I, you know, was working with him, there were some hiccups in terms of the product itself. And like, I did a deep dive on the category in terms of like, who are the players? What are the brands of mastija that are selling in Greece that are relevant? Who's exporting? And what I saw really quickly is that there were so many weaknesses in the category, packaging being one of them, liquid being another, you know, marketing being another, right? So even with Skinos, which is a great brand, it's delicious, there were problems. Like I, you know, and I got to say this lovingly, right?
Sure.
But I put him into a big event called the Manhattan Cocktail Classic, and I had some real heavy hitters that were doing the cocktails for the event. And we were doing a specific cocktail that we had to batch out. So batching is like when you're making drinks for 500 people, right?
Okay.
So, they called me up, and like one of the guys is now global for Jägermeister, and he was like, oh, F, this juice is messed up. I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, yeah, we just made the same drink, same recipe, 3 different bottles, and it's totally different.
And they have a palate that they would know.
Correct. Now, again, I'm not saying that a layman would notice this.
Right.
However, my whole thing with bringing this type of product to the US market, and I call it trickle-down marketing, right? We know trickle-down economics, meaning you penetrate the market via influencers, whether it's chefs, you know, high-level mixologists who are going to really adapt something like this that's so esoteric and so unique,
right?
Which was exactly who I did my initial focus groups with, right? So in my mind, immediately, I was kind of like, oh, there's no way I could hang my hat on a product that's got like consistency issues. That's like
101,
that's the basic thing. That would be like you making a light that it works sometimes and then it doesn't work some of the time. You know what I mean? So, and again, this isn't, again, really to like knock the product.
Sure.
It's just the fact that I am such a perfectionist. And I believe when you, like me, I don't come from money. I say always 2 things. Your currency is your word and your relationships.
100%.
And if you break your word or mess up your relationships, for me, I would have nothing.
Yep.
And so there was no way that I could work on a product that may compromise my relationships. You know what I'm saying?
Were they listening to you with this feedback?
A little bit, but it was like the typical Greek response where it's like, oh, you know, it's an agricultural product. It changes season to season and boodoo, boodoo, boodoo. And I'm just kind of like, all right, well, there's got to be a way to fix that.
Yes.
Right? And so when our relationship kind of ended, I kind of was like, I got to see, you know, my whole thing was like, I want to create the brand to be the global brand, to not only fix the problems that exist in the category, but to be the example of what a true luxury spirit from Greece looks like, tastes like.
Absolutely.
All of it, well, you know?
And having that experience with major global brands, right? Like you were coming in with, hey, we know how this works globally for all these different
right.
brands. Trying to apply it to a Greek brand
right.
at the time just wasn't a fit.
Right. And look, I mean, Metaxa is over 1 million cases worldwide. That is not
Sorry, when
something...
you say a million, that's a year, just so our terminology.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So is that
Annually.
What you quote? So when someone
that's,
talks about...
That's big brand status.
Gotcha.
You crack, I mean, that's... Jägermeister, just to make it relevant, used to sell about 3 million in the U.S., shy of 7-10 years ago,
what?
Just in the U.S. alone.
Jeez.
So 1 million cases worldwide, that's a brand someone wants to acquire.
Okay.
In the United States, if you can crack for a startup brand, you can crack 20,000 cases annually, you're a target for acquisition. In the recent M&A environment in the US, if you can crack 5,000 cases,
right.
you could be a target
really?
For acquisition. Yeah. So
where was Skinny Girl? Remember Skinny Girl Martini?
Skinny Girl Margarita. I mean, look, she had the power of Bravo, which,
yes.
you know, later on in my career, I was the marketing manager for Di Serrano.
Oh, wow.
So I managed the US budget. It was about a $7 million budget. Frankly, it's not a lot of money in the grand scheme
that,
of things
okay.
when you're talking about the kind of money that liquor brands spend. But it was a decent amount, 350,000 case brand in the United States with Di Serrano. So we did a lot of TV. The TV ads were a little corny. I mean, part of my role when I was there was changing the creative
yeah.
on the TV ads.
Why do I
ads?
Feel like I remember it too? Di
because
Serrano.
They were like, yeah. Di Serrano on the
yeah.
rocks.
Yes, yes, yes. I do remember that.
So... But we have eat up on Bravo,
okay.
long story short. That network is phenomenal. Why? Because women are watching
yes.
this programming,
yep.
right? So
it helped just
powerful,
accelerate that. Yeah.
Totally, totally. So you're talking about, you know, very much right place, right time with, you know, Bethany Frankel. And she had a partner that was an industry expert.
Yep.
So
and
that needs to be known.
Absolutely.
You know?
So we have a beautiful bottle here, and I want to get into the details. So the average listener to this podcast doesn't even know when we're talking about Mestija, right? What is it? Let's bring it back. Like, this is not a vodka. It's not a gin. It's its own category. Mm-hmm. So in your 2008 soberish eureka moment, at that time, did you say, I want to start this brand, or I just like this so much, I want to get behind this type of product?
Well, you know, at the time, again, we're talking, I was like in my late 20s, early 30s. I don't know. It's all a blur at this point. but no, I mean, you know, just like I said, I got introduced to the owner of Skinos. So I just thought, oh, let me be this person's like number two, you
right.
know? But then this person wasn't willing to give me equity, wasn't willing to pay me what I was worth. And I mean, that's a whole nother conversation
yep.
about, you know, just women in business and the fact that we get paid less than men and
Absolutely.
This whole thing, right? That's a whole nother conversation. But
by the way, don't lose your train of thought.
Yeah.
You're my first female guest on the podcast in
All
27
right.
episodes.
That's
hey,
awesome.
That, right?
And that's awesome.
We need more, and it's not by, but I'm excited for that. So thank you.
So back to your question, which was,
did you always think the right opportunity, I'm going to start my own brand, or was it just organic?
No, it happened because, you know, like I said, that relationship fizzled, and I kind of was at this stage when that happened. I was actually very depressed, you know, I was really depressed because I felt a little taken advantage of. I kind of felt like, you know what? I'm tired of building brands for other people and not being, you know, paid my worth. And the other reality is I was in New York at the time. I was living in New York. Mm-hmm. So this was like 2008, right around the economic bust. Yep. All right. And I had a lot of buddies. I had two older guy friends of mine that started LeBlanc Cachaça, which ended up selling to Bacardi. I had another buddy of mine, Steven, who started a brand called Illegal Mezcal. God, there was another guy I knew that had started a cachaça brand. So we're talking, there was a lot of this startup activity, right? And it was people that I knew. And, you know, it kind of was just like, this dude could do it.
I can.
You know what I mean?
Really?
And yeah. And that was really kind of my thought process. So it really happened organically. And I could run circles around MBAs because I learned this all school of hard knocks.
Right.
You know, I got my ass handed to me when I first started trying to raise capital.
Okay.
Because all I had was a vial of liquid and a PowerPoint that was a business plan with like a budget. It wasn't like a proper cash flow exercise or anything like this. That said, I had guy friends that were raising capital that I saw their decks. There was holes in them.
Yep.
And again, like, I don't want to make this like a, you know, feminist hour here, but objectively, there were males that were able to raise capital with weaker propositions, you know, holes in their propositions. Right. And I couldn't raise a dollar, you know? So.
And you have the experience, like you started from bartending, from going to the venues, from.
Right.
You have that grassroots.
Right. I mean, we're talking at that point, I had done everything other than finance and logistics, right? So experience with execution. And I will also say that along in that startup environment, what you typically saw was marketing folks in the liquor industry that were starting brands or finance dudes.
Gotcha.
Right? So the finance dudes saw all the exits and want to get a piece of the pie.
Yes.
And then the marketing folks are kind of like, yeah, we know how to do this, right? But the big difference is when you've actually sold and you know how difficult it is to sell one bottle, never mind 20,000 cases, there's a big difference to that. And like I consulted for a lot of these marketing folks,
sure.
Right? Where guess what? You raised some capital to get a brand off the ground. You now sit in an office doing administrative work and you have to hire salespeople. That's eating up cash flow.
Yep.
Because you're not, as a founder, usable to drive volume. So there's a big difference between like creating strategy and actually being able to execute.
Big difference.
Right?
Yep.
So, and I'm not trying to be cocky here, but a big strength for me, I have been running this business as a one-woman band for 5 years now.
But you say one, like literally aside from the producers.
Aside from some people that do tastings for me in store, I've been running this as a one-man band and I've opened up 16 states and 6 countries.
Come on.
Okay. So, you know,
over how many years has this been?
It's been five years now. I launched March of 2018 in Massachusetts. So I am my salesperson, my marketer, my PR agent, all of this thing. I'm not saying that that's an efficient way to do it. I've had to do that.
You've had to do that.
Okay. I am now finally at a point where I'm ready to hire salespeople, which is super exciting because it's exhausting.
Yes.
You know,
but you're on every weekend. Like you're out at tastings. You are the face of the brand. You're passionate about it.
I've been doing it all.
Right.
I've been doing it all.
You met someone this weekend. They call you today and you're already not to veer off.
Yeah.
You know, this is a good conversation. We have 18 conversations going, but still to this day, like it's establishing itself, this brand, because you're driving it, but you still go to tastings. You're still sponsoring events. You still want to be there and make sure this is the first time you're trying a Mastika of Clio's. Give me that feedback.
Yeah.
What is it? Like, that's intense.
It is. But the thing is if I didn't truly believe in what I was doing, I wouldn't be like, I'm not interested in sitting at home and, you know, being a puppet master. Okay. Like, yes, we're entering a phase where I'm going to start to be able to delegate. We'll raise a Series A in a year. Okay. We'll all have 20 people on the ground. But as a founder, When you can go do an in-store tasting and you got people that meet, like, you're never meeting a founder at Total Wine. You know how many customers I have that still buy the product because they met me in store? It makes a difference.
Yeah,
it makes a huge difference. And that also creates that organic word of mouth. And it also creates that, you know what? I met this girl. She launched this off her mother's couch in Boston. I want to support that. And I'm going to tell my
100%.
Friends. You know what I mean? So I don't ever want to be the Wizard of Oz locked away in the ivory tower. Staying connected to your customer is the way that you're going to always kind of know what the market wants and then be able to scale and grow the brand accordingly. Like, I'm looking at doing some flavors potentially. You know,
yep.
I've been getting requests since the beginning for a smaller bottle for the 200 ml size, you know, so I'm just conscious that, like, I want to listen to the market and
Absolutely.
Be able to be responsive, you know?
Well, and that's put you in a position where you're succeeding. So today, in prep for you coming here, I ran out. First of all, I Googled. I'm like, okay, Kleos, I've never tried it, right? And I haven't had Mastika in over 5 years. And it was always in my mind. By the way, Ipovrigio, I knew it growing up as vanilla.
Right.
I didn't know that was Mastika up until now. You just reminded me.
Yeah.
I used to eat that shit. Like, I used to love that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I do like Mastika. I call Highlight Sellers here in Newport Beach. Hi, do you have Kleos there? Let me check. Yeah, we do.
That's so great.
They go, wait, before you did that, he goes, is that Greek brand? He said that. I go, yes. He goes, it's got like this ornate, pretty bottle. The guy on the phone. I go, yeah, that's the one. He goes, yeah, you want me to put one to the side for you? I'm like, yep, I'll be there in the hour. So it was just cool that you're still pushing for the brand recognition. But this guy was like, is that the Greek brand? And then is it the pretty bottle?
Yeah.
Like, that's pretty cool.
I
like,
love
just,
that.
Right?
It was
that. And when I went in, there was a woman that was checking me out at the station. Mm-hmm. And she goes, I go, hey.
Yeah, she was checking you out, but she saw the bottle.
She saw the bottle. I didn't have the bottle yet, so she was just looking at me. I go, do you sell a lot of this? She goes, I see a lot of bottles come through here a lot. I go, have you tried? I'm just curious now, right?
Yeah.
She goes, I've never tried it, but everyone that comes in here does that. And then my last question was, male or female, who do you see most?
Yeah.
Right? And she goes, mostly women.
Yeah.
Like, this was her feedback.
100%.
And I'm like,
well, it's on the money.
It's on, yeah.
We skew about 60-40 female, male.
Okay.
Yeah.
So as we get into Mastika, can we get into this?
Yeah, let's go. Let's crack it open.
Let's crack it open. All right. So you do the honors of cracking it
all
open.
All right. And this is another thing that's really nice. And I kind of like took this from my Di Serrano days. So the Di Serrano cap, if you know it, kind of like spins. And so there's a similar effect with the Kleos cap.
So is this all your, from everything, the brand, the logo?
See that? Pretty.
Oh,
so it's
yeah.
like little working flair. And then if you get one of these bottles and you place it on a bar outside and the sun's hitting it, it actually creates like a rainbow prism effect
on
your bar top.
Did you design everything?
So I worked with a designer. He actually, named Sean, and he actually worked on a lot of the LeBlanc Cachaça, stuff, but I had worked with another very high-end designer who I won't name. Yeah, we'll do a little squeeze of lemon. That's great.
Okay.
I worked with a high-end designer who had done a lot of perfume bottles.
Okay.
So what I want you to do is this. I want you to try it by itself first, then squeeze the lemon.
Okay.
And try it. Sinigamas. Cheers. Opa.
Ooh. That's delicious.
And then try it with the lemon.
Wow. That's smooth.
And then you can pop some Pellegrino on top. Give it a little bubbles.
While we're drinking this, that goes down way too easy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Totally.
That's really good.
Totally.
What's your most popular cocktail? Like, what's one that you're seeing in Miami here?
So right on the bottle is the Cleopatra.
Okay.
So that also goes, you know, back to why I named this Kleos. I wanted a name that could lend itself to cocktail names. Kleos is the root of Cleopatra. Cleopatra, female, Greek, dynamo.
Yes.
Ties right in, right? So the Cleopatra is three ingredients, Kleos, basil, and lemon. And this drink was created by a guy named Michael Menagos, who's frankly the Dale DeGroff of Greece. For people who don't know who Dale DeGroff is, I mean, this, call him King Cocktail. He's an American that worked at the Rainbow Room in New York in the 80s and is kind of credited with the reviving of classic cocktail culture in America.
And Rainbow Room, for people that don't know, is like the iconic bar in New York City, right?
Right, yep. Right. So Michael Menagos was that person in Greece who, I'm going to say 90s, was working at a bar called Bar Guru along with another gentleman, Thanos Brunatos, who now owns Babarum, which is on the world's 50 best bar list. So these were guys that were doing cocktails when people were all drinking Ursus in Greece, right? So, and for people who don't know what Ursus is, it's like this sloe gin in a bottle, very yes. cheap alcohol that for some reason Greeks were doing shots of.
That and Gordon Space, right. Like official sponsor,
totally,
right?
Totally. So I met Michael early in my, you know, entrepreneurial journey when I was working for Metaxa, and the guy is like polyglot, speaks French, Spanish, Italian. I mean, he's literally a gentleman and a scholar.
Okay.
An absolute class act. And yeah, he made that drink. And it is so simple to make and so delicious. It's literally Kleos, basil, lemon. Easy peasy.
And that's it, yeah.
So this serve we just had, muddle some lemon,
yeah.
Muddle some basil, 1/2 ounce of lemon juice, shake it up like a mojito. Beautiful.
Wow. Yeah. This tastes so good. And there's health benefits.
So look, we can't make health claims for an alcohol product, okay?
Disclaimer.
However, Mastika itself, and this was one of the reasons that I fell in love with this thing, is a superfood. You know, it's the ancient Greek superfood. First prescribed for medicinal purposes by Hippocrates, who's the Greek father of medicine. First referenced in the first known pharmacopoeia by the Greek father of pharmacology, Dioscurides, who wrote a book called De Materia Medica in Latin, which listed plants, botanicals, herbs, their healing properties, combinations of those things to cure ailments.
Right.
And in that book was referenced both cannabis and Mastika. So long history of its use for medicinal purposes. Modern days, there's hundreds of published medical studies proving Mastika's action against H. pylori, which again, like we're talking about being in the market, you know, we're doing store tastings and I'm like, oh, Mastika, you know, kills H. pylori. It's the bacteria that causes peptic ulcers, gastric cancer, acid reflux. You know how many Americans I meet that have H. pylori, have had H. pylori,
right.
Have Crohn's disease, IBS. I mean, not sexy things, okay?
Yep.
Right? But America has a gut health problem, and Mastika is one of those things that, frankly, and a lot of people also don't know this, the Chios Mastika Growers Association is primarily concerned with selling Mastika for its medicinal purposes. It's officially recognized as an herbal medicine in the European Union. There's two big pharma companies in the EU that buy 40 metric tons of Mastika annually and put it in pills for people who have GI problems. So, you know, it's a natural remedy for all things gut health related. Besides that, it's antibacterial, antimicrobial, anti-inflammatory, and antioxidant. So it's used in skincare as well. Mastika is used in surgical thread in the European Union because the body actually absorbs it and it helps with skin regeneration and wound healing.
Okay.
So because of that, it's used as an ingredient in anti-aging products. So there's a couple American brands, Tata Harper, which you can get at Sephora, super expensive organic skincare line from Vermont. Chanel puts Mastika in their blue serum cream, which is ingredients from all the blue zones. Estee Lauder is now using Mastika as well. So it is a fascinating product. So besides gut health, skincare, it's also used in oral hygiene. Mastika was the world's first chewing gum. It is the root of the word to chew in all the Romance languages. So in French, it's mastique. In Spanish, it's masticar. In Italian, it's masticare.
Come on, I didn't know.
Another cool fun fact. And I mean, now I sound like the dad from My Big Fat Greek Wedding, but like, it's legit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's crazy how many things we have in Greece that have this level of depth in history. But I'm going to argue that, you know, I call this Greece's best kept secret because this discovery moment for me. So first it was discovering the liquid and the flavor, which is super delicious. Then it was researching the raw ingredient. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, why is this not like acai?
Yes.
Why doesn't everybody know about this? I'm going to make this happen. Like, this stuff is a marketer's dream. You couldn't make this up and have a better story.
Absolutely.
You know?
Your passion for this is unreal. Like, this isn't turn the camera on and I'm passionate. Like, you're insanely passionate about this, which is just exciting. This is delicious. Like, again, this moving forward is when you go to someone's house as a gift, this is perfect to give it to the American who is not connected to Greece. Like, it's a great conversation starter.
Totally.
Right? Like, the other one that's a vodka, like the Greek vodka one, I can't think of the name, doesn't matter, has a nice bottle, mm-hmm. and it's a conversation starter, just, but it's not Greek. You could get vodka anywhere. Like, this is a great conversation starter.
Yeah.
You know, and you go somewhere, like, that's going to start going in my mix of, hey, when you're going to someone's house.
Americans fall in love with it. They really fall in love with it. And that's really what keeps me going.
Right.
You know, the idea for this came in 2008. I launched in 2018. I've still been doing this as a one-man band, ready to scale and hire people. I'm not saying that I haven't had low points. Every entrepreneur does.
You'd be lying if
you
were.
But, you know, the reaction I get from people is what keeps me going. I know this is something very special. I know, and I knew from the beginning that I could make this the next global Greek spirit brand.
Right.
I just needed the tools to execute. And the biggest tool is capital.
Capital,
you know?
Absolutely.
So
that's incredible.
By the way, segue us into another conversation.
No, but really quick. So let's zoom out a bit. The world, Greece. Greece has thousands of islands. There's only one island that produces the trees that produce the sap that is masticar. Could you just explain that?
Yeah.
So the island of Chios is the only island in Greece and the world that produces this. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So why haven't people taken these trees and tried to go to?
They have.
Even to other islands?
They have. Turks specifically. I mean, the history of Chios is so fascinating. And then the history of Chios in relation to the Ottoman Empire is even more fascinating because through 400 years of the Ottoman Empire, the Chians were always protected, never raped, never killed, because the Sultan in Turkey, like, masticar was the prized possession. So really fascinating history. And frankly, it was the fact that masticar exists today, we actually owe to Genovese Italians. Genovese Italians came and settled Chios around the 11th, 12th century, and they built walls around each of these 24, what they call masticochoria, the masticar producing villages, to protect them from pirates and from the Ottoman Turks.
Oh, really?
So that, and they also helped organize the systematic cultivation of masticar so that it could be commercialized throughout the Southeast Mediterranean basin. And it was spread via the spread of Christianity because it was considered to be one of the biblical resins along with frankincense and myrrh. So you want to talk, like, why does masticar come only from this island and only from the southern part of the island? There's like the scientific story and then there's the folklore story. I'm actually more akin to believe the folklore story, frankly, which is a religious story. And it's a really beautiful story that was told to me by a local mestuza. So mesta is one of the masticochoria.
Okay.
And it's the story of Saint Isidore, which is Agios Isidoros, who's the patron saint of Chios. And supposedly, Agios Isidoros was a Christian in non-Christian times and converted two working girls to Christianity. And for this, he was punished by the local government. They took his body, dragged it around with a chariot, you know, across wood, stones, beat him bloody, and left him on the side of a road in a field of mastika trees to die. And the story goes that the trees cried in sympathy for the dying saint.
No.
And that the saint looked at the trees and said, "May your tears be a medicine for the world." And so that story, they say, is the reason that the southern part of Chios is blessed, was blessed by the saint, and that these, this particular resin, which they call the tears. So in Greek, we call it dakria mastikas.
Oh.
So it's the tears of the tree, because the way you cultivate these trees, and I'll back it up again a little bit. So the specific tree is called the Pistacius lentiscus, var, meaning variety, hia. So the Chios variety of this Mediterranean shrub. So the Mediterranean shrub grows throughout the Mediterranean.
Okay.
However, that particular variety only comes from these 24 villages.
It's insane.
Right? So you can talk science, you can talk terroir, microclimate, you know, mineral analysis of the soil. I've asked the Growers Association a lot of these questions. Sometimes they're vague because they're super protective, right? But, you know, and one of those things also is kind of systematic cultivation over time, that the ancient Chians, you know, knew how to take care of these trees, cultivate these trees, and continue the harvest. They also historically were picking the best trees to repropagate. Like, you can take a branch, you cut the branch off, you stick that in the ground, that in 5 years is a new mastika tree.
Okay.
So it's not something that has a seed either,
by the way,
right? So you can talk all these scientific reasons, but I'm more convinced of the folklore
reason. Folklore.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Even this region, can they produce enough for the world?
Yeah. Can Jalisco, Mexico produce enough agave for the world for tequila? I mean, people ask me this question all the time, and so do investors. There's over 1,500 brands of tequila. The growing region for agave in Jalisco is very similar in size to the growing region of mastika.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's globally known, right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So there's 1,500 brands of tequila. Is there an agave shortage now? Yes, absolutely. Are tequila brands bastardizing their production methods? Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
However, with mastika, it is a nascent category. That's why I call it, again, Greece's best kept secret. There are about 40 brands of mastika in Greece. 80% of them are artificial flavor and aroma.
So what do you mean? They take the sap from the actual trees?
They don't take the sap. 80% are artificial flavor and aroma. So it's literally 80% of what's called mastika in Greece is actually fake product. It's not PDO Chios mastika. So the only way you know if a product is PDO Chios mastika is it's going to have this stamp from the Chios Mastika Growers Association.
Okay.
And I'll tell you what the stamp says. Afedigi mastika, you know, ekatotsekato afedigi mastika, 100% authentic mastika. And there's this, you know, particular stamp that's from the Chios Mastika Growers Association.
Okay. Let's focus here. So if I go and start making my own champagne and call it champagne, but it's made somewhere else, they're going to come after me.
The TTB, which is the governing body for alcohol in the United States, does a lot of rigorous work on categories that are already old and accepted. So with tequila, you've got the CRT, the Comisión Regulatorio de Tequila, which is the governing body for tequila in Mexico.
Sounds like a cartel.
Kind of, not exactly. Yeah. But like with tequila, all tequila is mezcal, but not all mezcal is tequila. So tequila is agave that grows only in the Jalisco region of Mexico. Cognac is brandy that grows or that comes from grapes that grow only in the Cognac region of France. It's the Uni Blanc grape, which is a varietal that is throughout Europe, but only in Cognac.
Okay.
Is this specific grape, you know, for Cognac. So all these categories are very old, very established. So not only within their respective countries, but then with countries that are importing these products, do they go through kind of rigorous, you know, paperwork, certifications and whatnot. With Greece, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. In fact, you know, I got into it with a guy who was in Washington State that was selling a product made in Washington State and calling it Mastika, and then an Ouzo as well, right?
Come on.
Greek company, hats off, love anyone that's promoting Greek products. That's great. We all win. Rising tides raise all ships. However, this is in disrespect to the laws that have been created by the State General Chemical Laboratory in Greece, which is the small governing body for Greek spirits.
Gotcha.
So there are laws that exist regarding ouzo, tsipouro, you know, and mastika.
Yes.
Right? So if I were to make this in Chios, let's be transparent. I don't make Chios in Chios. I buy from the Growers Association. I made in Lesvos.
So okay. You ship from one island to another island, which is known for
ouzo? No, I'm buying mastika. I'm buying the raw ingredient from Chios, and then we take that and we distill it on another island.
Gotcha.
Okay. So if I were making it in Chios, I would also have what's called a PGI, which is Protected Geographic Indication.
Okay.
I only have the PDO because I'm buying PDO Chios mastika. So my dream actually is to be able to make it in Chios. Why am I not making it in Chios? Because I couldn't find a distillery there that frankly was like up to snuff on the production methodology that I wanted to get the liquid that I want in this bottle.
So what would change? That's great information. So of the 80 or so brands.
And I'm telling you, like, nobody knows this information. Barely anybody knows this
information. Do we cut this out of this episode?
No,
or we share it?
Oh, no,
okay,
it
good.
Should be shared.
It should be shared.
It should be shared.
Good.
Because people need to be better educated on Greek spirits, and that Greek people themselves need to be more educated on these laws.
So let me ask you, if I'm going in Greece and there's 80 different brands of Chios and you're saying 60 or so are...
I'm saying the first thing that you do is look for the stamp from the Chios Mastika Growers Association.
Okay.
The Chios Mastika Growers Association is a collaborative. It's about 3,000 families that own trees, harvest them each year to collect this resin. And then there is a, you know, again, self-governing entity that they then give the mastika to. They get paid according to the weight of the mastika, how clean the mastika is. So this self-governing body regulates mastika, also controls the price wholesale for the global market, and then also vets anyone that wants to come in and buy.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I had my eureka moment in 2008. I launched in 2018. I spent a lot of time meeting farmers, meeting the people running the Growers Association, you know, really trying to get in their good graces as well, right? Because not anyone can just call up the Growers Association and be like, oh yeah, I want to buy 40 tons of mastika. It doesn't work that way. There is a limited supply annually. You have to be vetted.
Yep.
Production quantities known. I've vetted my business plan out
a lot.
To a million cases worldwide. So I'll leave it at that. However, there is no security for anything that comes from an agricultural product. Just like there hasn't been security for tequila and big brands. We're talking big heritage global brands have had to change their production methods because of the shortage.
Because of the shortage.
So the Growers Association is very kind of protective. And that's also why, like, I call it Greece's best kept secret, because, you know, they want to grow, but they're also very protective.
Sure.
Of the product, you know? And it's frankly more Greeks that are doing mastika products than like any foreigners, okay? So this is also a very special thing because no big company has come in to like buy up all the mastika trees. This is still literally 3,000 families.
That's incredible.
And the families own 50% of what's called Mediterra, which is the company that owns the mastika shop. So the mastika shop is the shop in the Athens airport, in Chios. They got like 5 other locations.
That's not a government shop? Or
no,
is it
no. Okay. That is owned 50% by the Growers Association and 50% by this company called Mediterra. And that shop sells everything under the sun made with mastika, from, you know, spirits brands to spoon desserts, chocolates, olive oils, tomato paste, you name it, you know, cosmetic things, like you name it, they sell it.
Absolutely.
So that's the other like really cool thing about mastika is you're like, oh my God, it's a chocolate. It's a liquor.
Yes.
It's a spoon dessert, you know, it's a tea, it's a cocoa, like you can use it in so many different things.
Absolutely.
It's so versatile.
Does it make you nervous building a business and scaling it and having an end goal and knowing, like, can they pull access from people and say, we're not supplying you anymore? I mean, that could happen in any region.
So, you know, I don't want to like talk a big game here, but I have contracts with the Growers Association.
So, yeah, so you're covered. Yep.
So this is as risky as starting a tequila brand right now.
Yep.
And look at every celebrity that's starting a tequila brand. So we'll leave it.
We'll leave it there. Yep. Yeah. That's amazing. So if you could change or enhance.
It's actually much more de-risked, frankly, because this is a nascent category.
Right. And it's growing. So when you're looking at this, do you have an end goal in sight as a business now? So the Mastika we covered as a business.
Mm-hmm.
You're building this, you're passionate, it tastes phenomenal. What is your end goal here?
I mean, the end goal is an exit, you know?
Yep.
I'd like to sell this to a strategic who can do the things that I cannot do, which is scale it to a global brand, you know?
And you have enough in your toolkit of skills.
To get it to that place.
Yes. And then you need it.
At this current moment, no, but I'll be raising a Series A that will get me to the finish line.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've read your story. How did it start? So you're in Boston. You're trying to raise money. Where did you go? Friends and family, I read.
So
how did you raise and how much?
I actually raised when I was in Miami. So, you know, I started a career in San Francisco working for Bacardi. And then my last executive role was, I mentioned Di Serrano before. So that was my last executive role in the industry. I was the go-between between Di Serrano Global and Bacardi USA. So I also speak Italian.
Oh, wow.
And Bacardi was the importer of record for Di Serrano. So I was also the first dedicated like marketing manager, brand manager for Di Serrano in the US. It was, frankly, I started all the nuts and bolts for the brand focus groups before I was working for Di Serrano. However, I was living in New York. I was literally scraping by because I didn't want to work for a corporate. I didn't want to work for a corporation because I really wanted to do Mastika, right? And it came to the point where I was like not making ends meet. And I'm like, shit, I got to get a job again. And so I took this job with Ilva, the company that owns Di Serrano. That job relocated me down to Miami. And I actually took my relocation and I paid a senior advisor named Tom Weiland, who was COO of Jim Beam for 10 years, CEO of Allied Domecq, which was a big, you know, multinational that owned Stoli, one of their big brands. He had been the senior advisor to LeBlanc Cachaça, which was friends of mine, Aviation Gin, which we know sold for beaucoup to Diageo. So when I was first trying to raise money in New York, and like I said, I was getting my ass handed to me, my buddies that owned LeBlanc were like, you need to get an advisory board, right? It was my first time hearing the term. And they're like, you should talk to our guy, right? And so I met with Tom, and I'll remember we were like at Soho House in New York. And he looked at me and he was like, you remind me of the Patron founder. He's like, you got it. I will help you. But that help didn't come, you know, for free, right?
Of course.
And so I used my relocation to pay him his like initial consulting fee, which, you know, and I love Tom. He's an absolute beast. He's an absolute shark. And he's the best negotiator I've ever met in my life. This man is like, you watch him in action. He's amazing. However, working with him proved that my business plan was pretty tight. My budget was pretty tight. And so it was the vote of confidence that I needed, which was the old white man that had been in the business for so many years that could actually give people a comfort level to be like, okay, I'll write a check.
Jeez,
you know?
Okay.
That said, I was working for Di Serrano. I had to put this on the shelf for a while because Big Brother was always watching. I'm in the Bacardi corporate office in Miami and I had a lot of work to do, you know? And so I kind of put this on the shelf. And then I would say 2 years in with that role, I had things kind of smooth sailing. I had to come in and, you know, upheave everything that was being done on DiSerrano. Fire agencies, hire new agencies, you know, create efficiencies, hire and train brand ambassadors. So I did this whole thing, got that brand growing, double digit, phenomenal. I'm killing it. Italy loves me. And then I came to the point where I was just like, if I don't get Clios off the ground, it is going to be written on my tombstone that I tried to make Mustika big, you know, because it was just like always in the back of my head. And by the grace of God, the Italians decided to leave Bacardi and start their own import company. I wanted nothing to do with that because it was going to be a whole nother, you know, upheaval, starting over again, you know. And I actually slept on a friend's couch, bartended, catering bartending for a while, and decided I got to start to raise money for this thing. Yeah. And my first $10,000 check was actually, now I'm going to get emotional.
Oh, geez. Come on.
Was a girlfriend of mine here in LA.
Come on. She believed in you.
Yeah.
Get out of here.
Yeah. And I didn't even pitch her. That was the thing. I didn't even pitch her. She just like,
oh my God, what a good friend.
She just, you know, was a witness to the whole story. And she was just like, F, I want to invest in this. And gotcha. She was a media person, had bought some property, sold some property, so had a nest egg.
Sure.
And at that point, it was kind of like, I have to do this, you know? And then I'm talking to another girlfriend of mine. She introduces me to a couple who, high net worth individuals. They owned a company that sold cushions for wheelchairs that had a special technology for the low back.
Millions.
That a Swedish company bought. And so they have been, you know, benevolent philanthropists, let's call it. They're in Chicago. And my friend Katarina introduced me to them. I pitched them at a bar in Miami. Next $50,000 check. And that's kind of how it happened.
Good you for
know,
you.
Like it just was, I went from being super scared to put myself out there to raise money to having some really good momentum. And I'm like, oh, I'm on a roll, you know? And that's kind of how it goes because you know, this 100%. Game as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like it's a momentum game. And it's also like, investors are kind of sheep, you know, they're going to follow on once the first money comes in, then they're more comfortable to write that check.
Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
I'm curious, why did you get emotional about your friend writing that first check? It wasn't about the dollar amount. What was it?
God, because it's like, you know, this wasn't somebody who's super wealthy.
Gotcha.
Do you know what I mean?
It
was someone
different.
Who literally had like a little nest egg from some smart investments that was willing to take a risk and be like, if I lose it, I don't care. Like, I believe in you. I know you're gonna do it.
Wow.
Right. And so, yeah, I mean, and frankly, most of my investors are that, you know, like, sure, there's some high net worth individuals that invested in, in Clios.
Yeah.
But a lot of them are Greeks. I have a very diverse cap table. Greeks, Latinos, African Americans, and women. It's awesome.
Really?
Not a single VC yet. Been approached by a VC recently. We'll see how that goes. I mean, I've raised 2.4 and change all in since inception, which you know is not a lot of money, which is why I've been like super tight with cash flow management, super careful.
Yes.
And, you know, some people may think like, oh, that's a lot of money. It goes so fast, especially when we're talking about COGS, you know, cost of goods on Clios are not cheap. This is not a cheap package. And my production method takes 2 months. Most Mustikas take a day to make. Clios takes 2 months to make, 6 to 8 weeks. All of that costs money. I use a neutral grain spirit base. Other Mustikas use sugar beet. My neutral base is more expensive. Everything on Clios is more expensive, which is why it drives me nuts when I get nickel and dimed from people like trying, you know, my margins are already really tight as it is because I wanted to make this an affordable luxury. Like in California, you can get Clios now for, what'd you buy it for? $33.99.
Yeah, yeah.
Something around there. $34.99.
Do they charge tax on this?
Yes.
Yeah,
of course.
I think it was $29 maybe, $30. Yeah.
That's a little too low. I mean, on the East Coast, we're at like $36 to $38.99.
The next, can you talk numbers? Like what, if one person came in or one firm, what's the next round look like? Like, what are you doing with that? Is it just the states nationally?
So a Series A is going to be an $8 to $10 million round.
Okay.
And that will enable me to get about 20 people on the ground and go aggressively into, you know, 48, 50 states.
Wow.
So I sell in Greece, UK, Turkey, new market last year. Turkey, very promising. Just started selling in Australia.
Great.
But the US is the most important market.
Canada?
When it comes to, yeah, we're in Canada as well.
Okay.
Canada's tax system is so insane that Clios is just really expensive.
Yep.
In Canada. So it's not a market that I can like do a lot of damage in. Imagine that Clios is more affordable in the US than it is in Greece.
That's insane.
Because of taxes.
Yep.
So,
well, in Canada has government controlled liquor stores in Ontario.
Correct.
So you're selling through distribution there and then they.
No, you've got to sell through. Right now we're just in the LCBO, which is the Liquor Control Board.
Yep.
Of Ontario.
Which is a Greek CEO, by the way.
Yes, right? Nick. Yeah. Nanos. And frankly, I literally messaged him on LinkedIn and that's how I got Clios in through there. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So then you get that next round. That's mostly like, can you, with more money, can you drive costs down, produce more, get better economies.
Yes.
Of scale?
Yes, but it's gonna be like a lot of volume before I start to get some good price breaks,
right.
You know? And then, frankly, I mean, I'll just be transparent. I'm always talking to glass companies.
Yep.
Because they're always soliciting, frankly, so. You know, you got to be able to pit one guy against another and kind of like.
It's part of the game.
You do it like that. Yeah. I mean, it's also risky because you don't want to be jumping producers all the time. China is not the funnest to deal with. Like most of your big brands, their glass is made there.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you've got the big companies, Saver, Bruni, which French and Italian respectively.
Yep.
Berlin's another big one. These are European companies, but a lot of them subcontract factories in China.
And China's switching their glass. So the government itself is pushing out a lot of glass. To produce glass, it's a dirty process, manufacturing process. We do a lot of glass with our fixtures.
Yeah.
And every year, every other year, there's like significantly fewer and fewer suppliers. Because the government's just, it's a dirty process.
Yeah.
Yeah. But does that, like, you could never produce glass in Greece. Like, it just wouldn't make sense.
So I tried. And here's the problem. So there was one last standing glass company in Greece called Eula. You know, I used to make this at Plomari. So Plomari gave me the referral. And when I was first starting out, we're talking like 2016, you know, first getting quotes on glass. Eula would not take my quantities. They were like, you're too small for us.
Yep.
Right. So I literally said to them, I don't care. I will pay more to do it in Greece and have it all made in Greece.
Right.
So that I can say this is 100% Greek product. I will pay more for the glass versus going to China. They didn't care.
They didn't care.
No. And then they subsequently got bought by a Portuguese company. So there's now no real glass company. There's no real glass company left in Greece. I believe there's some smaller ones that do olive oil bottles, but not anyone that can supply for the quantities.
Sure.
So it's unfortunate. And that's just the reality of what's happened to Greece in general. With a lot of things.
Yeah. And even this, there's no bubbles or anything.
No,
in this
it's good quality. Like, look, there's Prada's made in China. Okay.
Yep.
So there's a lot of great quality, product coming out of China, but there's also a lot of bad factories. So you just gotta vet who you're working with.
I always tell this to clients when they're like, oh, you make your product in China. I'm like, yes. And you can buy a lot of crap in China, but we also make product that's in some of the best jewelry stores that are selling the
right.
Most expensive jewelry. It doesn't matter. It's when you own your own factory, set up your own production and control the quality, it doesn't matter where it's made.
Right.
Would I love to have all our lighting made in the USA or made in Canada? Absolutely. But there's no manufacturer that does that. You're importing the drivers, you're importing this.
It's the unfortunate reality of what's happened in the United States. We don't manufacture anything anymore.
Absolutely.
It's sad.
I had a retail client who in a meeting, just to be an asshole anyways, he wasn't the nicest guy. Where's your product made? I'm like, Asia. He's like, China? I'm like, China. He goes, and he just did one of these. I'm like, and it was a large retailer, won't say the name. I go, where's your garments
and
made?
Then you can point 20 things in there made in China.
Yeah, he goes, China. I go, different China, I guess, right? Like,
yeah.
Again, I'm not sitting here an advocate, but you got to do what makes sense. The product that's carried in the Chinese product is Greek, right? So you just got to look at that. I got to pour myself another. This is fantastic. So anything else dealing with Greece? I know you grew up first generation, Boston,
yeah,
right? So both your parents were from there.
My parents were immigrants.
So they were immigrants. Yeah. Yep. Same here. So being reconnected with Greece, what were some of the things that you saw that you're just like, oh, this is great. This is what I love being reconnected, right? Through your last job. And then what are some of the things that you're like, does it make me proud to be Greek?
So when I started working for Metaxa, there was kind of, it was a time when all the big strategics, the Pernods, the Bacardis, the Diageos of the world were doing brand ambassadors. You know, it was a thing for marketing. They wanted their brands to have a face. Typically, these people had some sort of a bartending background. And typically, if it was, you know, my friend Simon Ford worked on Plymouth Gin, London Dry Gin. He's a Brit, right? So when the role with Metaxa came about, I remember I called my dad and he was like, you have to get that job, Eftimia, you know? Like, and I'm thinking to myself at the time, like, how cool that I can get to represent a Greek product
totally.
In this business. Cause yeah. I had been in the business and I'm like, this is awesome. I was so excited. It was frankly a grueling, like 5 month interview process. And I wanted this job so badly. I mean, I wish I had my follow-up letters and emails from that time. I mean, I was gunning for that
sure.
job. And so, when I got it, and like I said, so interestingly enough, it also came at a time, you know, you grew up first generation. By the time I got to college, you know, I did Goya, Sunday school. I was in it. I was doing Greek
beat
dance.
Beat over the head with it. Yeah.
Yes. I was beaten over the head with our culture. And, you know, it was always kind of like Milan est in ecclesia. They're talking in the church. You know, someone saw you with a boy or whatever. And it was just nonsense. Like I was a straight A student.
Yep.
I was the first child. So I got it bad. I mean, all of it, the kutala, the belt, the all of it. Okay. And, by the time I got to college, I literally was like, I'm done.
Yeah,
I want nothing to do with the Greek community.
Yep.
And starting to work for Metaxa was like this weird coming home. Right. And I'm back in Greece and I hadn't been in Greece in 12 years. And so that, never mind that trip to Mykonos, like I bounced around
sure.
Athens and the islands. And it was just like an instant reigniting of the love affair with the old country, because it's something, especially when you're first generation. And we went back in the summers when we were kids, we would stay in the village with our grandparents. So when you have that experience, you know, being Greek is something that like it beats in your heart.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And so being back there, the food, the drink, the ocean, the all of it, you know, it was like, God, why was I away for so
why?
Long?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And so I then became the stereotypical like Greek and proud. I'm now representing Metaxa
right.
around the United States.
Which is a big deal.
Dealing yeah. with the Greek community all around the United States, which was a whole experience in and of itself.
Right.
Because we talked about this earlier. Chicago Greeks, New York Greeks, Boston Greeks, Florida Greeks, they're all a little different.
All different.
You
yeah.
know?
But we'll always all are bound by asking for a deal, right? Like that's the common cash money deal. Like that's the
totally,
common.
Totally. So Yeah, you know, there was that part of the experience. And then respective to, you know, Mastija, and I said this earlier, you know, the really sad thing was that realization of the fact that here we have this raw ingredient that's a PDO. You know, the PDO is an EU term. So the European Union, once they came together, you know, they created, like, call it a program where there's an official designation for products. PDO means protected designation of origin ingredient, right? So feta has a PDO, Mastija yep. has a PDO, cognac has a PDO, right?
So, which means when you have that PDO, producers outside of that region or area cannot produce and use that term. Is that what it?
Technically, that's what it means. But we all know that Bulgaria and France export cheese that is called feta here in the United States. Where that breakdown occurs, I don't really know. And right. it's something that the governments need to be a lot more diligent on because, hey, you want to sell your goat cheese that kind of tastes like feta? Great. That's French goat cheese.
Yeah.
Don't call it feta. You know what I mean? So that's the thing with Mastija, and the very sad realization that I had is that the majority of Mastija sold in Greece is that artificial flavor and aroma. You know, and I said to you earlier, Ielada Troita Pediatis, you know, we have this beautiful thing that only comes from this one island. It's so rare. It's so expensive. You know, there's farmers that work very hard to yes. cultivate these trees and create this thing that has value. The whole island, you know, I had one farmer that said to me, "I Mastija ine olo to ine tu nisiu," which means it is literally the fabric of the island is around Mastija.
Yes.
You know, and shipping. Yeah. Chios is also known for shipping, by the way.
And they're all in New York now too, right?
Yes. Right, totally. So, you know, you have this thing and it's the Greeks themselves that have destroyed the value of the product because they give it away for free.
Yes.
Think about this for a minute. I'm creating a luxury brand from a raw ingredient that's super expensive and super rare, yet you go to Greece and then you get it for free. So if I'm an American tourist, I go to a restaurant, they give me some Mastija shots for free at the end of the meal. Do I then want to pay for it? I mean, it's one thing when the owner is giving you something special, right? But it's another thing when the entire magazine gets something que eras menos.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like you were saying, the grappa example. Like,
right. But the bigger problem there is the fact that now selling in the Greek market, the Greeks themselves will buy the cheap pedalitro. I'm going to say the 5 liter, you know, I get a 5 liter for €7. And it's like, well, I can't compete with that.
No.
Like my cost of goods is way higher than that. I can't compete with that. And I'm also making a quality product, respectful of the laws,
absolutely.
Respectful of the local people and what they do, you know, and also trying to elevate Greece in the process. You know what I mean? Because I said to you before, you know, France can take a piece of rubber, give it an appellation and sell it for $1 zillion because the French are geniuses at marketing.
Yes.
That dates back to like Louis XIV, France, right?
Yep.
He was literally the first marketing genius in France.
Why? I don't.
And then you have the Italian glassmakers, you know, why? Because Louis XIV had the first court of, you know, these master chefs that created all the master sauces. He bought expensive Italian glass to create the Hall of Mirrors at the Versailles Palace, right? Like, he was the first literal marketing genius that created luxury. And in Greece, we have all these beautiful things, you know, Icaria, 1600 indigenous botanicals and this honey. And we are, you know, it is the island where people forget to die. You know, you've got Chios and Mastija. You've got ouzo, not my favorite category, but we have the best anise in all of Europe growing in Lesbos,
yes.
right? So we have all these olive beautiful
oil,
things.
Like,
olive oil, 60% of Italian olive oil is bottled Greek olive oil. Feta cheese, never mind feta cheese, graviera from Naxo, all these other things that are produced from different regions in Greece that we could sell for tremendous high amounts of money, you know, One could argue, do we have again supply for global? Well, hey, then it's the law of supply and demand.
Right.
You know what I mean? The price just goes up and it becomes something that's ultra, ultra premium if you want to have something coming from Greece. So we have all these special things, yet we don't know how to market and sell them properly.
No,
you know?
And that's a great way of putting it. And then everyone in Greece thinks they're going to get rich quick by bringing out their own version of something, right? So you have Greeks are the... We're notorious for this where, oh, I opened up a cafe right here. He's my friend. I'm going to go across the street and then there and there and there.
Yeah.
And then I remember the yogurt, frozen yogurt craze. Do you remember in Greece? Nothing, no shops. And then one opened up that summer. The next summer, yogurt shops were all over, like frozen yogurt. Like,
yeah.
Greeks just have that thing, right? Where you flood the market instead of working together. I love that there's a growers collective group, mm-hmm. right, that controls it. But what would you do? You, if you were in a position of power, what would you do to, just talking about this, not about anything else, what would you do for the Mastika to protect
so
that?
So the State General Chemical Laboratory, along with the Greek government, should be vetting every product that says Mastika on it. And if they are not buying from the Chios Mastika Growers Association, if they are using artificial flavor and aroma, they should not be allowed to call the product Mastika.
Right.
Period. End of story.
With penalties.
With fines? 100%.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, the Greek government can do it, okay? The Greek government has crippled Greek citizens, you know, because the pendulum swung from one end to the other. Nobody paying taxes to now, the tax man is looking at everybody.
On a $2
right?
coffee.
I mean, I have my aunt and uncle make olive oil, right? And the amount of elenco that they get now from the government. They also have animals. They have to
scrutiny.
The amount of scrutiny they have to, prepi na dilosune how many animals they have. They can't take their goat cheese and then go sell it to their neighbor anymore. Do you know what I'm saying? Because the tax man's got to get their money, right? So we went from one extreme to another. So if they're going to do that to the average Greek citizen, then they should be able to do it to companies well.
And protect, protect these precious regions.
Correct. Because at the end of the day, it's about protecting these raw ingredients.
Yes.
You know, to me, the worst thing that could happen would be that a big brand comes out and they're making artificial flavor and aroma. This other thing the Greeks do, the arpachto, right? Like, oh yeah, we could make Mastika big, like make an artificial flavor and aroma. You know what I mean?
The Italians are doing with the olive oil, by the way.
I mean,
you're saying 60% is Greek. Do you know a lot of the mafia in
I've
Southern
heard Italy? North Africa as well.
But they're importing vegetable oil, food coloring, they're adding food coloring and aroma, and they're selling it as extra virgin olive oil back to North America.
Yeah.
So like every group has it, but if you're blatantly selling something, how do you not have this label and enforce it?
Look, I'm trying to educate and that's the best I can do, but it's a heavy boulder to have on your shoulder.
Absolutely.
But Chios, Effie, integrity, ethics, very important. So, this could get bought tomorrow. If Bacardi, there's no way that a large strategic is going to change this formula to a degree that it doesn't respect the laws.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Maybe quantities of Mastika would change, things like this. That's just reality that happens with acquisitions. But the law is that Mastika has to be bottled in Greece legally to be called Mastika.
Yeah.
So again, if this comes to an exit, someone could look at me and be like, oh, you're just looking to sell it and make it big and whatever. The producer is going to win at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And that's a win-win is very important to me as well. You know what I mean?
So your passion, like last segment, I would love to talk about your passion. Like why, if you sell this and you make tens of millions, whatever you make, you deserve it. You're passionate. You're bringing something unique to the market and you're insanely just talented with this, right? Why can The Rock do it? Or Kevin Hart and sell, or George Clooney and sell, and we're okay with that. We should be supporting young entrepreneurs who are doing their thing, female owned, right? Because this is a male dominated industry. So this last segment, just talk to me about the challenges as a female owner in the space, creator, and like just how you've been navigating. Because it's not easy.
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest challenge is raising capital. 2% of VC funding goes to female-owned brands, you know? So regardless—
In this category or in general?
In general.
In
general.
Say
and
that
it's
again.
Even worse in alcohol 2%. Beverage. It's even worse in alcohol Jeez. Beverage. So, you know, that is a really glaring statistic. And, you know, I always say, if you asked me 10 years ago if I was a feminist, I probably would have rolled my eyes. You know, I'm a girl's girl, but I'm also a guy's girl. I've always had a lot of guy friends. Like, you know, anyone watching this right now, I've definitely got masculine energy, you yep. know, so I'm not afraid or intimidated very easily. But raising money for Kleos was a very humbling experience, to say the least. And also, evidence of that glaring statistic, right? Not very easy to overcome, which is why, look, my seed round, which was 1.8 million, took me 15 months. And I had guy friends that were like, oh yeah, I raised my seed right. in 3 months, 6 months. And I just was just feeling inferior yeah. a lot. You
know, you had a quality product offering, right?
Yeah. I mean, it just, you know, and again, I don't want to go like, oh, woe is me. I'm a woman brand owner. It sucks for us out there.
Right.
It kind of does. But that didn't keep me from keeping going and being persistent, you know? And so I just think persistence, stick-to-itiveness has been a really important part of my journey. And then like the success is what speaks for the brand, you know, in terms of the markets we've opened, the distributors that we're with, all of that. You know, I've laid a really good foundation and planted these seeds. And I just want any investor that, you know, now we were approached by a VC fund, any investor to see, look what has been accomplished with such minimal resources
Insane.
By one individual.
Yeah.
And just water those seeds and see the plant grow. Like it's, you know, that's yeah. it. That's all I can hope for in the future.
Absolutely. And just last comment on that for me is like, look what you've done for the DiSeronos of the world, which is a global brand, and bringing it here and doing that.
Yeah.
You had the resources to let you do what you needed to do. I hope you get the next round to take it to where I hope you have a successful exit. But until then, like, let's get these into more bars and people's homes. And, you know, I'm excited for you.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen. The other funny thing about Greece is we definitely are a poor country, but we have a lot of wealth and a lot of wealthy people.
Yes.
You know, I could probably raise a Series A alone from Greek investors. So
let's get some eyeballs
yeah.
to this.
Yeah.
8 to 10 million.
That could be eight people. It literally could be eight people.
Eight people.
Could probably even be three people.
Right. Just to get it. I love it. I love it. Thank you so much for sitting down.
Thank you.
Like we got to have you on more often and just talk about stuff, because it's not easy, right? Like being motivated. We're going to talk, you know, on the next one, just self-motivation. Like, how do you wake up every day? Like, for me, there's more downs than ups.
Yes.
But those ups keep you going.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
And you're creating something totally new in a very saturated space, right? And to be able to have that experience to do that, you should
be
so proud.
It's a saturated space, but it's a product that completely cuts through the clutter.
Yes.
I mean, there's barely any Masticas selling in the United States.
Right.
You know? And people get really excited about this. I mean, good for the gut, low cal, low sugar, low alcohol, woman owned. It's all the things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's all the things people are looking for.
Great bottle to give us gifts, right? So let's say that for
Yeah.
Well.
I mean, look, no, one thing I will say that also like makes me really proud is when Americans say like, oh yeah, that looks Greek.
Yes.
Because my whole thing was I wanted this to have a very strong Greek brand identity, which was another interesting thing with my experience working at Metaxa. When I worked at Metaxa, we did a lot of like marketing exercises at our global brand conferences, which would be like, okay, let's do, you know, breakout groups. I'm with the Russian and the German. We're in a breakout group. They give us a task of like, okay, create this, you know, ultra uber premium age Metaxa. What does the bottle look like? What do you call it? Et cetera, right? So we do these marketing exercises. And Greece, in terms of the brand team there, was always afraid to be to Greek. I found this very, very interesting.
Huh.
And think about this from like a historic standpoint, right? We have been self-governed for such a small period of time in terms of our country, right? We hate authority. Greeks are fiercely independent. So although there is a degree of Greek nationalism, there's also a degree of kind of like self-hatred in a way, mm-hmm. where if something, like I said, this whole two Greek thing was kind of like, what does that mean?
Right.
You know, where it's like the, what is considered to be kitschy, souvlaki, opa, saganaki,
break up fustaneles,
yeah. this kind of thing,
yeah.
they want to stay away from it. Right. So that was another thing with me with Kleos is how do I make this identifiably Greek, but very modern and chic for a global consumer? And
right.
there's great brands out there right now doing it, like New Greece, let's call it.
Yep.
Is super exciting.
Very exciting.
You know,
very
like there's a brand that I love called Zeus and the Oni. That's a fashion brand.
Okay.
I love their brand because it is, again, it is an identifiably Greek clothing line that veers away from kitsch.
Yep.
So, you know, that was kind of the, that was kind of the goal. But I think we're in a place now where Greeks are proud again. I think the economic bust in that whole capital control era was a very depressing time for Greece as a country. You know,
absolutely, and prepared them for COVID. Like they
yeah.
rolled into COVID, just depression.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just starting to come back, but there's some really fresh, young
yes.
energy in Greece that's really exciting, and I feel like Kleos is kind of like part of that
yes.
wave. You know,
and that's who you need to latch on. So you trying to go there and get to the local taverna. To be a, that's not,
it's you, not going to happen.
No, there's a great Canadian that just, Constantine Telebikos, great guy from Toronto, lives in Athens now, and he's doing so many amazing things. He's opening up his own co-working spaces, starting like a gin brand and a fashion brand and just very dynamic.
Yes.
This is like just an example of people returning to Greece, doing amazing things. And those are the people.
There's also Greeks in Greece doing amazing things. I think Edgon is a super strong brand. The Three Cents Boys, you know, had a nice exit. It's a Greek soda brand.
Yep.
Why I'm having trouble rattling them off the top of my head. But there's a lot of, I mean, Greek hospitality. You know, you look at Costa Navarino,
yes.
places like this that are becoming world-class resorts for the jet set.
Absolutely.
Like, we have that, you
oh,
know?
Yeah.
We can do that. And the brand of Greece itself is a strong brand. You know, it is aspirational. It is luxury.
Yes.
But there's two sides to that. There's two sides to that coin, right? Where the old school Greek Americans, and I hate to say this, but it's like our parents' generation, what they brought to the United States was more of that old school
village
thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is also special in its way when it's done right.
Yeah.
You know? So,
but my,
yeah.
my challenge now is when I go to Greece, I'm there several times a year for work and then I go family vacation. To me, Greece is not going there and only staying at a Costa Navarino, which again, shout out, great place.
Yeah.
Like to go there and just stay at resorts and go to another expensive resort
yeah.
and you're paying 1,000 euros a night, but the person working there is making 700 euros a month.
Yeah.
It doesn't sit well with me. And that's not the Greece.
I agree.
Like, right? Like you go to a Kalamata. I want to go to Taverna and I don't want it to be so fancy. And I want to be in flip flops where, you know, right now you have the Mandarin Orientals of the world. They're opening up and this is, you know, 5-star ultra luxury resort, 4,000 euros a night to stay there, 4-night minimum. That's great. And that caters to a small,
certain clientele,
which
yeah.
is good that we can do that. But my fear in general is like Greece just becomes too much that way.
Yeah.
And your average Greek can't survive there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, it's a balance, but yeah, I don't know. I don't like that. If I have to go there to just sit in resorts for 2 weeks, I could go to Arizona and stay
yeah,
in a resort.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not my style. I mean, last summer I was there for about 2 months. I stayed in Chania for 2 weeks
okay.
at an Airbnb, and it was, I mean, I love Crete. Yes. I can't speak highly enough about Crete. I love Crete. I love Ikaria. I also went to Milos. I also went to Folegandros. I can't afford to stay in those places. I went to Navarino for 2 days because they hooked me up and gave me a deal because they carry Clios.
Yes.
But the experience, and I mean, I love the place. It's absolutely stunning.
Stunning.
But I could have been in the Hamptons. I couldn't tell the difference.
That's what
I'm
saying.
You know what I'm saying? So it felt like that very American golf resort type vibe.
Yep.
And I want to be with the locals, you
Absolutely.
Know?
Absolutely. Yeah, we have a rule. I can't stay more than 3 nights in a resort like that.
Which is why Chios is super cool, by the way. Okay. Chios has no luxury resorts.
Right, right, right.
Barely anything there. Like, I mean, Kadris is the most luxury you can get, and it's, you know, by comparison, not even close.
Okay.
So
I've never been, but
you gotta go.
All my New York homies, I used to live in New York. It's like, I get it, guys. You're from Chios. So I
yes,
get it, right?
Yes.
Chios, and what's the other? Naupactos. Most people are from there.
In New York?
In New York, they have a lot of,
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I felt like I was surrounded by Chiotas in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like the Chioticos Piti and, yeah. I don't know, but I can tell you, being from Tripoli, Chicago has a lot of Tripoli Chiotas.
All Tripoli.
And then I just found out recently that York Ubaro, Thanasi's also from Tripoli.
But his wife's from Crete.
Dina from, you know, that does all the concerts here in California is also from Tripoli.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a big,
awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's exciting. What's the best way for people to stay in contact with you?
Follow on Instagram. It's @drinkclios.
Yep.
So the word drink, K-L-E-O-S.
Yep.
I still answer all those messages.
Amazing.
Yep. So that's
amazing.
The best way to get in touch.
And then
it sells online for people that aren't in one of the 16 states that we distribute in. buyclios.com.
Okay.
Super easy. Ships to like 48 states.
So you could ship cross state lines and...
Correct.
Okay.
I don't do this directly.
Yep.
It's illegal for us to sell direct to consumer, old liquor laws, but I have a third party that runs an e-shop.
That does all that.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad we were able to sit here and chat today.
Me too. This is awesome.
You. And I'm not just saying it, delicious. I'm already on my second cup here. So thank you so much.
Love it. Cheers.
You're awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Invigorate Your Business with George Strombolos. Please hit the subscribe and like buttons and follow me on all the main podcast streaming channels. Also, please share your comments when you can. I appreciate your help in expanding this network to a worldwide audience. Until next time, stay invigorated.